Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people who are better equipped to help us understand a very important front in that war, particularly at the moment, than a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm very pleased to say, Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent experts on Asia. He is the author of two terrific books, both of which are very relevant to our topics today, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China. Gordon is, of course, frequently seen and heard from in other outlets, including The Daily Beast, Forbes.com, The World Affairs Journal, Fox News, and elsewhere. But we're particularly proud of having him here each week with us. And Gordon, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you so much, Frank.
I think Happy New Year is in order, but I'm not sure it's going to be. What are we to make, Gordon, of the latest twists and turns with respect to a North Korean intercontinental ballistic missile range device being sent our way and Donald Trump's statement that it won't be allowed to happen?
Well, Donald Trump has certainly unnerved the North Koreans with that threat. Because although, you know, Trump may have just tweeted it out, nonetheless, the North Koreans take that extremely seriously, and they should, because the United States is going to have a new policy toward North Korea. It's going to not be patient, as we've had strategic patience in the Obama administration, and it's going to be much tougher on China, which is an important aspect of all of this. The North Koreans are saying they could launch an intercontinental ballistic missile anytime, any place, which means that they probably are going to try to test their KN-08 or their KN-14, which sit on the back of Chinese launchers. The Chinese gave them the transporter erector launchers, and that gives Kim the ability to surprise us. We don't really know what Kim has up his sleeve, but at least from his statements, that would be an indication that we're going to have a mobile ICBM test fairly soon.
Indeed, he referred to the fact that these missiles could be launched from any place in the country at any time, and mobile launchers would certainly give that capacity. And also frustrate an idea that, interestingly enough, the man now serving as Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, and one of his former bosses, prior Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry, some time ago wrote about, which is the idea of preemptively attacking the launch sites. There was a lot of talk over the weekend, Gordon Chang, about things rapidly escalating into an actual war with North Korea. Do you think that's in the offing? And if so, what needs to be done to either prevail in it or prevent it from happening in the first place, better yet?
Well, war is always a possibility on the Korean Peninsula because the Kim regime, over the course of decades, has used violence to upset status quos that they found to be unacceptable. I don't expect war, but nonetheless, we have 28,500 service personnel on the Korean Peninsula. They're backed up by 50 or 60,000 in Japan and, of course, by the rest of the U.S. armed forces. We need to have those people in place to deter Kim. This has been a successful policy in the sense that there has not been a general war since the 1950s. But, you know, with Kim, with a very different risk calculus than the rest of us, with his regime shaky, we cannot exclude any possibility.
To the extent that what might come of all of this is a shootdown of one of these missiles in flight, presumably that changes somewhat the calculation from actually using military force against these weapons on their launchers, fixed or otherwise. Gordon Chang, do you anticipate that if, as even Ash Carter himself has said, if one of these missiles happens to be launched in our direction, perhaps Hawaii or maybe Alaska, that we would shoot it down, quite apart from what Donald Trump might have in mind, would you reckon that that would have the same kind of impact on North Korean thinking as a more direct, violent action.
Yeah. Secretary Carter's statement that the United States would shoot down a missile coming our way is to be expected. The Japanese have been saying this for quite some time before every expected North Korean missile launch. I don't think the North Koreans are going to actually try to airmail a missile towards the United States. But nonetheless, this is a statement of deterrence. And clearly, if we in fact do shoot down one of these missiles, there's going to be a confrontation, not only with North Korea, but with China as well. We have to expect that because China has shown increasing willingness to back the North Koreans over the last couple of years, especially with surreptitious trade and sometimes even trade in uranium for North Korea's nuclear weapons program. So we have to be prepared to defend ourselves, and we also have to be prepared to deal not just with the North Koreans.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, the Chinese have equipped the North Koreans with these mobile launchers, which are extremely problematic. Gordon, one of the other things that's problematic at the moment is there's a considerable political upheaval taking place in South Korea and further tensions between two of our allies in the region are arguably most important, the place where those American forces are based, South Korea and Japan. Could you talk quickly about the sort of strategic environment in which these calculations of war and peace are being made?
Japan recalled its ambassador in the last few days over a controversy regarding sex slaves. These were South Koreans who were impressed into the Japanese army to serve, to give sexual favors to Japanese soldiers. This was an issue that was solved by Seoul and Tokyo with an agreement, but this is becoming undone. And this is probably a reflection of the extreme political crisis in South Korea right now regarding the impeachment of the president, Park Geun-hye. This unscrambles all sorts of things that we thought were settled, including the placement in South Korea of an American missile defense system, THAAD, Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. Mm. This is very important for us to keep those missiles there to defend South Korea, Japan, and the United States. And clearly at this point, there's going to be a reconsideration of that decision by Seoul because of the political crisis now engulfing the country.
Have they actually been deployed so far, Gordon?
It takes months for them to deploy, and I don't believe that they will be for another 7 or 8 months.
I think it's still in the works, indeed. But does it create a further complication, needless to say, that our allies are at loggerheads and we somewhat undone, perhaps, in terms of some of their defense cooperation with us as a result?
Absolutely, Frank. The United States, for a very long time, has tried to get the South Koreans and the Japanese on the same page. And the Obama administration, to its credit, was able to make a fair amount of progress in its second term. However, the elements of progress now seem to be in danger of being undone because of this political crisis in Seoul. And this has reverberations not just on the Korean Peninsula, because if the North Koreans see an opportunity, they could engage in some sort of adventurism that could degenerate into a conflict that could engulf not just the peninsula, but indeed the region.
Yeah, we need to get this bucked up and sorted out for sure. Gordon, finally, speaking of China, there are people musing about the degree to which President-elect Trump has, with his tweets and some of his other decisions, notably the phone call with the Taiwanese president, really rattled the Chinese, making them very uncertain about what he's about and what they should be doing in response. Give us a sense of how you think that is playing out in Beijing at the moment and what it might mean for regional tensions and perhaps conflict as well.
There are two apparently uncoordinated reactions from Beijing right now. There's the military reaction with very hostile maneuvers, including flying around Taiwan twice. Also, the diplomats, though, seem to be taken for a loss. They have not been able to mount, I think, an effective response to Trump. I think, as Aaron Burnett of CNN said, no one has ever talked to the Chinese like this before, and they're not used to it. You know, eventually they'll be able to craft a response, but right now Trump is on the offensive, and that's a great thing, Frank, a great thing.
Amen. Gordon Chang, a great thing indeed, as are you and your visits with us each week. We look forward to them greatly, as we will throughout 2017. Next up, Greg Roman joins us. We'll talk about the latest terrorist attack in Fort Lauderdale and whether there's a bit of jihad there as well. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say our guest is Greg Roman, the executive director of a terrific organization based in Philadelphia, the Middle East Forum. He is a man who has had considerable experience in the subject matter on which the Middle East Forum focuses, namely, of course, the Middle East, but also threats to our country that emanate from it. He has also served as the political advisor to the Deputy Foreign Minister of Israel and worked in the Israeli Ministry of Defense. Greg Roman, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back and Happy New Year.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here, and I can't speak enough about the high accolades that the Center for Security Policy gets in our responsible counter-Islamist circles, and it's always a pleasure speaking with you and working with you.
Thank you. Well, those counter-Islamist circles are usually derided by others, and I did want to say a particular word of thanks to you and to the Middle East Forum for your excellent riposte to one of those who is constantly inveighing against all of us, the Southern Poverty Law Center, in your new product, Field Guide to the Useful Infidels. A very well done piece of work, I think. So thank you for that. Let me ask you about this recent terrorist attack down in Florida. Greg, you of course, have a lot of experience tracking bad actors. And one of the things that has thrown a lot of people off the scent in this case, it seems, is that the alleged perpetrator, Esteban Santiago, first of all, has an Hispanic name, and second of all, had time in the United States military. Are there other things that we've learned about him that, however, suggests there may be more to it than that?
There are. There was a report that came out from Robert Spencer on Jihad Watch over the weekend, which was able to link Mr. Santiago to his viewing and consumption of information affiliated with Islamist propaganda. And I think that there's a key point here that not a lot of the mainstream media commentators have picked up on. Many of them have been categorizing this as a soldier who went to Iraq, viewed two of his close friends killed in a bomb attack, and came back and then started experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. He was inebriated by mental health issues. But what they don't try to connect is how someone who may be having a certain limited faculty with his own ability to have cognizance of what's actually going on in the world can be influenced by Islamist propaganda. So the mainstream media is calling this a case of depression gone wrong, getting onto a plane, arriving in Fort Lauderdale, and committing a premeditated act of murder against five Americans. But what they're not doing is showing how the different groups, like whether it be ISIS, Global Jihad, Al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood, are able to take advantage of individuals with mental health issues, and in doing so, are able to dig down and then get to a really distinct point where they're able to prey on individuals who may have a weaker mental disposition than others.
You know, what's interesting, Greg, though, is what this guy was doing even before he went to Iraq, which was creating at MySpace recordings of Islamic music, some of it very explicitly in the sort of vein of Islamic supremacism. So it's a complicated bit of business, I think, to be sure. But the rush to say this has nothing to do with jihadism seems to me to be, as is often the case, misplaced. Let me ask you about one other issue that I know is on your mind, too, that I want to discuss in light of your experience in Israel, but also the great work that you do at the Middle East Forum, Greg Roman. And that is, what do you make of what Barack Obama is doing on his way out the door with respect to the U.S. relationship with Israel and more to the point, really, Israel's standing in the world?
I really think that for the last 8 years, Barack Obama has been the architect of the step-by-step destruction or the attempted destruction and implosion of the U.S.-Israel relationship. I can remember going back to 2009 and 2010 when I was serving in the Israeli Defense Forces and working at the Ministry of Defense, where he would send his envoys, his political appointees, to our offices and criticize us for alleged interference in Palestinian building, asking us to stop the natural growth of Jewish towns in the West Bank, and he would every time come back with something else and a new message. And then when we saw the settlement freeze end because of Palestinian intransigence, we saw Obama blame Israel. When the second Secretary of State under his administration, John Kerry, came in after Hillary Clinton left, we saw them attempt peace negotiations. After Israel made an offer, the Palestinians refused. Of course, Obama blamed Israel. And then you saw a general slide into quiet of the Obama administration's commenting on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But this was not because Obama became frustrated with Israel. He was actually planning interference in the Israeli election in the last Knesset elections, trying to spend hundreds of thousands of American taxpayer dollars to underrate organizations in Israel with the goal of trying to dethrone Benjamin Netanyahu from the possibility of him becoming prime minister for a fourth time.
Now, wait a minute. So you're telling me that the man who has been of late railing about alleged Russian interference in American elections has himself been deeply involved in trying to interfere with and, change the outcome of the election of a friendly nation, Israel?
Correct. And he didn't treat Israel as a friendly nation. I mean, if you know this, there was three levels of his electioneering and interference in the Knesset elections. The first was by dispatching Democratic Party advisors to Israel to advise Israeli opposition parties. Now, granted, Benjamin Netanyahu also had the assistance of Republican-oriented election advisors, but Obama's sending was in a consistent theme of Democratic Party politics going all the way back to 1996 when Bill Clinton deployed the Raging Cajun and Jim's Carville to try to assist the election of Shimon Peres. And then again in 1999 with the election of Ehud Barak, which was actually able to unseat Netanyahu. Now, fast forward 16 years later to these last elections, it wasn't just sending political advisors. It was also providing international cover and attacks on the Israeli government that would provide election fodder for the Israeli opposition. And the worst case of interference was when the State Department directed, as I said before, hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Middle East Peace Initiative, something called MEPI. It's a program ran out of the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs to support a get-out-the-vote operation and an opposition research operation against the Likud party and his coalition ally. Now, all three of these efforts failed. Now, when that happened, Obama realized that he had one last shot to try to undermine Netanyahu, his government, and largely the state of Israel in the international arena. And back in, I would say, November of 2015, President Obama started making inroads with the individuals and countries that he knew would be on the Security Council, and also he drafted a paper asking for State Department options to bring the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to a close on Palestinian terms, rather than that of protecting our ally Israel. And we saw those actions starting back in June and July when I first came out with the reporting on what the State Department was planning on doing.
Let me ask you, Greg Rumman, closing. Do you anticipate that there will be further damage in this wrecking operation at the Paris conference on the 15th of January and possibly at the UN Security Council 2 days later?
Obama has three options, and I'll start from least and then go to the worst. The first he may do is a Rose Garden speech after the Paris Peace Conference outlining his vision for a future Palestinian state. The second is that he may be able to bring those parameters to the Paris Peace Conference and have an international agenda drafted against Israeli interests in Paris, and that may not arrive in the Security Council. The worst option, and this is something that we have to take into consideration, is that the Paris Peace Conference may call for the establishment of a Palestinian state, not through negotiations. It might then be backed by a UN Security Council resolution, and we may even see President Obama recognize the state of Palestine.
This we will be fighting tooth and tong, as I know will you, Greg Roman, and Daniel Pipes, and others associated with the important Middle East Forum. Come back to us very soon with your analyses and updates. And in the meantime, folks, check out their great work at meforum.org. www.jihadwatch.org. Greg, thanks so much for your time today. Let's talk again very soon. Next up, Dr. Michael Rubin joins us. We'll talk about the death of Rafsanjani. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined by one of the country's preeminent experts on matters of great interest at the moment, notably Iran and Turkey. And we will talk with him about all of those. He is Dr. Michael Rubin, a resident scholar at the highly regarded American Enterprise Institute, a man who has done yeoman work teaching our servicemen and women around the world about issues in which he is expert. He is the author of several very important books, including most recently, Dancing with the Devil. It's a history of U.S. diplomacy, much of it misbegotten, I am afraid, with rogue regimes and terrorist groups. Dr. Rubin, it's so good to have you back. Thanks, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Frank.
So, Michael, we are now being once again fed what seems to me to be a propaganda line about this character, former Iranian President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, who has figured prominently in the Islamic Republic of Iran's affairs for decades. Is he, in fact, a man whose passing this weekend should be mourned by Americans or celebrated?
Well, I mean, certainly the world is a better place with Rafsanjani heading to a location far warmer, Frank. And the fact of the matter,
very warm.
Exactly. He was part and parcel of the Islamic Republic from its very founding, and he had his thumb in many of the key decisions. The 1994 attack on the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires, for example, he had signed off on. He was the father of Iran's nuclear program, and he didn't believe that this nuclear program was meant for deterrence. On December 14, 2001, he argued that Iran could use its nuclear weapons offensively against Israel because Iran had the strategic depth to absorb a second retaliatory strike, whereas Israel didn't. If that's the definition of moderate in the Islamic Republic, then we're pretty far gone.
Yeah. Well, and that does seem basically to be the definition, at least to hear most people talking about it these days, Michael, that he was so moderate, he was so pragmatic, he was kind of our best hope. People have pointed out that that seems to have been, as much as anything, born of the fact that he was immensely corrupt and therefore a guy that we could buy or otherwise do business with. How does that reflect on what I guess might be said to be his successor, this fellow Rouhani, who is now the president, also described as a moderate pragmatist and so on?
Well, I mean, this is one of the ironies. Within the Islamic Republic context, Rouhani was always understood to be the Mr. Fix-It. He was the guy that first Ayatollah Khomeini and now Supreme Leader Khamenei would go to pull the wool over the eyes of the Westerners and relieve economic pressure on the Islamic Republic. And he has done that very, very well.
He's even bragged about it.
That's what I was going to say, Frank. I mean, the irony is he has bragged about this. He has said that through dialogue, you can actually continue to import all the materials needed for special programs, read ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons, and the West will be fine so long as you have dialogue. He talked, Frank, about a doctrine of surprise where you lull the United States and Europeans into complacency, and then you deliver a knockout blow. And there is a broader problem that includes not just Iran here, Frank, in that whenever we have enemies, whenever we have adversaries, we want to believe that factions matter. You talk to diplomats dealing with the Middle East or journalists there, they will talk about hardline versus more moderate Hamas factions or Hezbollah factions. The fact that the moderates also embrace a covenant which calls for the genocide of Jews seems to, again, fall by the wayside.
Yeah, the so-called hawks versus doves, when the doves are every bit as predatory as the hawks, it turns out.
We could say the same thing about North Korea.
Yeah. One other man who is said to be at death's door is this Ayatollah Khamenei, the current Supreme Leader of Iran. Michael Rubin, based on what you know, do you have any bookmaking as to what comes next in Iran?
Well, this is one of the one of the big issues. Khamenei, it's not just a rumor that he's on death's door. He suffered earlier this year from colon cancer, and unlike the Soviet Union, where people would get colds and suddenly they'd be dead, what Khamenei allowed was the Iranian press into his hospital room to take pictures of himself in bed in order to prepare the Iranian public for the inevitable. Now, here's the trick with the Islamic Republic. There's nothing that said that the supreme leader has to be one person. If they cannot reach a consensus, then you could have a committee of people, and this can be both beneficial and dangerous, because beneficial in that it can increase internal discord inside the Islamic Republic, and I shed no tears whenever our enemies are paralyzed by internal discord. But on the other hand, you could get into a dynamic where they each try to prove their revolutionary credentials by acting out, engaging in terrorism, and that could make things much more dangerous.
Let me turn to the country next door, in which you've also spent a lot of time, Michael, over the years, Turkey. We've seen more terrorist attacks there. We've seen more crackdowns by the government. We've seen repression of members of the press and like. What is the future, as you see it, for this regime? Now making a common cause, it seems, with the Russians, but more generally, a problem, it would appear, for us, for NATO, and maybe for the region as well. Your thoughts?
Well, it really has become the Trojan horse for NATO, Frank. And on top of which, when you purge tens of thousands of security officials, not all of whom were followers of Fethullah Gulen, who you've discussed on your program before, when you rotate many more policemen around, when you arrest, frankly, more teachers than you do terrorists, it's no surprise that terrorism can thrive. Counterterrorism relies on intelligence. On terms of the military, Turkey now has one pilot for every two F-16s simply because they've arrested so many pilots. You've got a situation here where Turkey is really going down a descent into a situation where economically it could end up like Venezuela. It's going to go into this alliance with Russia, and the United States is living in la la land if they think that somehow the Turks don't mean what they say when we read the incitement every single day in their government-controlled press.
Yeah, and that's incitement, of course, not just against the Kurds, but very much
against
us
the United
as well.
States.
Yeah, where do they actually line up on the Islamic State, Michael Rubin?
Well, Turkey has become Pakistan on the Mediterranean, Frank, and they can talk a good game about countering the Islamic State, but they've given aid and assistance to the Islamic State. Now, to be perfectly blunt, many Turks will say, actually, Erdogan has been much more favorable towards the Nusra Front, and that sounds all well and good until you remember that the Nusra Front is an al-Qaeda affiliate. However, there has been some efforts to support the Islamic State, and whether Turkey continues that or whether it's simply going to change its tact now that it's suffering this blowback is another question. But the fact of the matter is, it never would have gotten this far, the Islamic State. Turkey wouldn't be facing this blowback had they not supported the group for the past 3 years.
Yeah. One of the reasons that they've been supporting it, it would seem, is that they, like other Sunni regimes, have regarded it as a necessary counterweight, Michael Rubin, to the Iranians and the Shiite crescent, some have called it, that's a building. You spoke of the Turkish economy being in trouble. I had long understood that Saudi funding and other investments from the Gulf had been essentially floating that economy. Have they been cutting back over new intra-Sunni rivalries and a desire to be the authorities who lead to the next caliphate?
Well, if they've either been cutting back or they can no longer afford to do what's necessary, if your listeners Google every day the value of the Turkish lira against the United States dollar, they will see a steady decline. In fact, it's lost about half of its value over the past year.
That's a serious economic difficulty. Let me ask you very quickly, Michael Rubin, we only have about 45 seconds. Can you give me just the quickest of assessments of what President Obama, John Kerry are doing to the U.S.-Israeli relationship on their way out the door?
they're trying to hobble it and trying to hobble whoever comes next. But in that destruction, there's actually seeds of hope, because the United Nations Security Council only matters as much as governments care to make it matter. It's like saying the emperor has no clothes. President Trump can simply recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. He can recognize Jerusalem as a Jewish state. He can close the shadow Palestinian embassy in Washington, D.C. He can cut off funding to the United Nations Refugee Works Administration, and we will be talking about a fundamentally new situation in the Middle East.
We will be standing by for, I hope, all of those things to come to pass. Dr. Michael Rubin, as always, I appreciate so much your time. Thank you for all you do at the American Enterprise Institute. Come back to us often in 2017, please. Next up, Patrick Dunleavy joins us. We'll talk about jihad in jail and what it means for you straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined, I'm very pleased to say, by Patrick Dunleavy. He formerly served as the Deputy Inspector General for the New York State Department of Corrections. He has been a consultant for the International Association of Chiefs of Police, has been teaching classes on terrorism, among others, to the United States military's Special Operations School, and he is the author of The Fertile Soil of Jihad, Terrorism's Prison Connection. Patrick Dunleavy, welcome back, I believe, for the first time this year. Happy New Year to you, sir. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me, Frank. Same to you. Wish you all the best in 2017.
Thank you, and you as well. Patrick, I want to pick up on the subject of your book. Prisons in this country, not just in Europe and elsewhere, are now the, well, incubators, I think is the right term for it, of jihadism, as a result in part of having Muslim Brotherhood chaplains introduced into those populations and free to recruit, not just proselytize, but indoctrinate and convert to not just Islam, but jihad. Talk about your personal experience with all of that and how worrying you think it is.
Well, what we found, and this was right on the heels of 9/11, when I was working with NYPD intelligence, we were looking at old leads that we had in regard to terrorism. And there was a lead that was provided in 1999 that had been somewhat overlooked. And that lead said that there was an inmate in the U.S. prison system who was converting inmates to a radical form of Islam, that the inmate himself had pledged an oath to Osama bin Laden. And not only was he converting inmates in prison, but then when they were released, he was facilitating travel overseas to the Middle East for them to continue their training. And that investigation uncovered a trove of who that inmate was. But we also found that it was an entire system that included clergy, religious volunteers, and literature that was in the prisons that were more of a Wahhabi Salafist theology. And that's what started us to embark and look at what was happening to inmates in the prison system in regard to terrorism and radicalization.
And you found, as I understand it, that this was a significant problem. Is that right?
We did. And we found that it was systemic, that it was not only present in the New York prison system, but that it was across the country in state and local prisons, as well as in the Federal Bureau of Prisons.
And Patrick, as you look at this and you hear about these campaigns on the part of people who are championing prison reform, criminal justice reform and the like, that they're insisting that you need to stop isolating prisoners, you need to start giving them more freedom of access to others in the prison system. given what you've said, this would seem to me to be a formula for still more of this kind of radicalization to take place, quite apart from the chaplains, just from jihadists who are already in the system.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, we look back and we, again, go back in history in 1992, El Said Nasser was in Attica State Prison for the shooting of Meir Kahane, a Jewish rabbi in New York City. And while he was there, he not only converted other inmates to his form of Islam, but he also conspired with individuals to bomb the World Trade Center in 1993. So, you know, we look at how incarcerated terrorists can influence the other inmates and population. And then we talk about this, whether you talk about recidivism rates or de-radicalization programs, that becomes a quantitatively more important issue when we talk about trying to reform or de-radicalize terrorists. It's not the same as if you have a substance abuse individual who's in prison and you want to offer him some sort of program to stop abusing drugs.
Well, Patrick, we've talked about this before in the context of specifically this idea of criminal justice reform translating into releasing early a number of these people, thousands, if not tens of thousands of them, in fact, if President Obama has his way. And I'm not talking about the, you know, the pardons and the commutations of sentences and the like that he's already engaged in. I'm talking about a systemic change that would reduce sentences, for example, drug traffickers on the grounds that they were nonviolent. And I think you've talked with me about the fact that that ain't the case, generally speaking. These are violent people. But Patrick, as you look at this and specifically the fact that we're having difficulty finding effective ways to de-radicalize people, this really seems to me to be a threat to public safety. Talk a little bit about that de-radicalization campaign, whether it's in France or in Germany, the application of it in Minnesota, what they're doing in Saudi Arabia. Has anybody, to your satisfaction, actually made this work?
No, they have not, and that's the unfortunate issue there, particularly in Saudi Arabia. If you look at their de-radicalization program, where actually some of the Gitmo detainees were sent when they were released from Gitmo, it's almost like going to the Waldorf Astoria. The prison system that they're in there, they're actually rewarded. They're financially rewarded. They're allowed to have conjugal visits with their wives, which in Islam you can have up to four wives, so every week they can have a wife come. And even they, in that program where they give financial incentives, still have a recidivism rate that is anywhere conservatively from 25% to 35% of the individuals.
And in France, they've actually recognized that this is a failure, is that right?
Yeah, they found out that they were in fact having just the opposite effect, that the French government officials realized that what they were actually doing was increasing the threat of radicalizing inmates by the way they were offering therapeutic services or special counseling. They were actually grouping the individuals together, and they were found to be actually stronger in their beliefs than countered or de-radicalized.
In a way, that should come as a surprise, basically. You're talking about people who are imbued with the true faith, teaching about jihad to people who are jihadists. I mean, how could it be otherwise if they're going to be reinforced in that perception that it's the God's will to engage in this sort of thing?
Right. One of the problems that happened in trying to bring this type of program into the United States, which a U.S. District Court judge in Minnesota, Michael Davis, has attempted to bring in, only one inmate was actually placed into the program, an individual by the name of Abdullah Youssef. He was arrested when he tried to get on a flight to Turkey to join ISIS and fight in Syria. When he got into the program, he went straight to a halfway house instead of going to prison. And 4 months later, he was found with a shank in his cell. A shank is a jailhouse term for a homemade knife, a box cutter. The other issue with the program in the United States is, unlike Singapore or Saudi Arabia, who have a state religion, in the United States, we have freedom of religion. Even the defense attorneys of some of the individuals in Minnesota who were arrested opposed the program because they would not allow their clients to be subject to the government changing their religion.
The bigger issue, Patrick, just very quickly, it seems, though, is this question of if you let these guys out, there is, whether the recidivism rate is 25%, 35%, something higher or something lower, an increased threat to public safety, is there not?
Absolutely. It's exponentially higher than any other type of inmate getting out. And the threat to be really crystallized is to understand that within the next 3 to 4 years, 100 inmates who were convicted of terrorist crimes in the United States will be paroled in the next few years.
This is a subject for further discussion. We look forward to having it with you very soon. Patrick Dunleavy, now writing regularly for the Investigative Project on Terrorism, former Deputy Inspector General for the New York State Department of Corrections. Thank you for your service to our country, sir. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.